You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey folks, before we start the show, I have a very important favor to ask of you. If you like what I've been doing here on Kick-Ass Politics, then nominate us for the 2016 Podcast Awards. Just go to podcastawards.com and nominate Kick-Ass Politics in the People's Choice category and the News and Politics category. And if you want to go the extra mile, then encourage your friends to vote for us on your social media and share your support on Twitter by tagging @podcastawards and using the hashtag PCA16. But hey, even if you can't do all that extra stuff, just take 30 to 60 seconds of your time to go to podcastawards.com right now and nominate Kick-Ass Politics for the 2016 Podcast Awards. You'll have to hurry, though, because the deadline is this Saturday, April 30th. So go right now to podcastawards.com and show your support. It'll be a huge favor to me, and you'll be helping to take the show to the next level. Thanks again for continuing to listen, and now enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. You ever look at Mount Rushmore and think, you know, there's an awful lot of room up there on that mountain? Maybe we could fit a few more up there. My guest today thinks so, and he talks about it in his new book, We the People, the modern-day figures who have reshaped and affirmed the Founding Fathers' vision of America, by my guest today, Juan Williams. He's a political analyst for Fox News, where he co-hosts the daily news show The Five. He's also a columnist for FoxNews.com and The Hill. During his 21-year career at the Washington Post, Juan Williams served as an editorial writer, op-ed columnist, and White House correspondent. A former senior correspondent and political analyst for NPR, Juan Williams is the author of the best-selling book Enough, as well as the acclaimed biography Thurgood Marshall, American Revolutionary, and the national bestseller Eyes on the Prize, America's Civil Rights Years, 1954 to 1965, the companion volume to the critically acclaimed television series. And now, in his new book, We the People, Juan Williams celebrates American leaders of the past century who he says are no less than modern-day founding fathers. They range from Billy Graham and Ronald Reagan to Martin Luther King Jr. and Eleanor Roosevelt. Some of them are a little controversial, some are less so. Some on the left, some on the right, and some in between. But Juan Williams says what they share in common is that they honored and extended the Founding Fathers' original vision while changing fundamental aspects of our country, from immigration to the role of American labor in our economy, from modern police strategies to the importance of religion in our political discourse. Today, we'll talk about the modern situations that our founding fathers could not have imagined or planned for, and how these 20th century leaders applied the founding fathers' principles to meet the challenges and changes of modern-day American life. We'll talk about some of the more controversial inclusions in the book. We'll talk about how some in the 2016 race used the Constitution more like a cudgel than a founding document. And one Williams will open up about the personal debt he owes to men like Martin Luther King, Ronald Reagan, and the Kennedys for making his American dream possible. Coming up with Juan Williams of Fox News in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
My guest today is Juan Williams. He's a former White House correspondent, a best-selling author, and writes a weekly column for The Hill. He's a political analyst for Fox News, where he co-hosts the daily news show The Five. He has a new book called We the People, the Modern-Day Figures Who Have Reshaped and Affirmed the Founding Fathers' Vision of America. Juan Williams, thanks for sitting down with me.
Ben, what a pleasure. You know, kick ass? That's pretty kick ass. I love the name.
Thank you. I don't even remember how I came up with that, but I really enjoyed the book. In it, you talk about leaders of the past century, ranging from Ronald Reagan, Thurgood Marshall, the Kennedys, to some perhaps more surprising and maybe even controversial figures. All of whom you say are no less than modern-day founding fathers. What do you mean by modern founding fathers?
Well, on the cover of the book, Ben, there's a picture of Mount Rushmore. Now, you looking at Mount Rushmore, you'd think, oh, Washington, Jefferson. But on this Mount Rushmore is Billy Graham, Ronald Reagan, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Thurgood Marshall. So it's new founders in the sense that here are people who have built on the rock put in place by the original founders, but they've reshaped America. Yeah. Reshaped America in keeping with the founders' values, precepts, the Constitution. And so when I say a new founder, it has to be somebody who's left a clear imprint on the nation, changed America in such a way that you would say, oh, this is the America that Ben lives in 2016. And when Ben is walking down the street, Ben would be able to tell you, oh, I know that, yes, for example, on the highway, there are cameras watching me drive. And Ben would say, yeah, I get it. They're looking for speeders and people who are breaking the law.
Yeah.
But if the founding fathers are watching Ben, they would say, Ben, are you kidding me? You let the government watch you as you drive, as you're about your private business? And Ben would say, well, yeah, I mean, you understand the trade-off, but that is a permanent imprint on the way Ben lives today.
Interesting. So are these people who are addressing issues that the founding fathers might not be entirely comfortable with, perhaps?
Well, in that case, exactly, yeah. Because that's the tension between liberty and privacy, mm-hmm. right? And in a way that I think the founding fathers wouldn't have tolerated. So you have to understand, we as Americans have gone through various eras of tremendous change. For example, westward yeah. expansion, right? Louisiana Purchase and the like, right? That's tremendous change. We've gone through Civil War, mm-hmm. okay? We've gone through Reconstruction. Of course, we have amendments to the Constitution that reflect the changes taking place in the society. Then you go through Great Depression, World Wars, Cold War, changes in economic structure of the country. All of that means that the founding fathers would understand the need for adaptability, flexibility. And so they would, at the same time, though, they're human beings. I think sometimes because, you know, look, if they showed up, they'd be rock stars today. Are you kidding? They'd be on Kick Ass. Right. You'd say, Ben would say, hey, come on in here, Abe. Come on in here, George. Come on in here, Thomas Jefferson. Come on in here, Alexander Hamilton, right? You would be like just one of millions of people who would love to have them on your show.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Whether they would tolerate me is a whole other thing. But
oh, no. They would be surprised at you, right? And at the idea of this kind of media having this yeah. kind of power and influence in the politics of American society. Because they would have no experience with it.
That's true. You know, but I'll bet Ben Franklin would take to podcasts.
As a former publisher?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he would be all over this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Why not? Well, in the beginning of the book, you also talk about, you kind of put yourself in that frame of mind yourself when you look at how much has changed just within your lifetime in the past 50 years, whether it's technology or in terms of social mores and so forth. Are there times when you look at the past 50 years and you feel like an old fuddy-duddy?
So I'm 62, right? And in my life, it's just incredible. I mean, certain things, I'm not even sure how they make sense of them. Like, for me, my parents smoked, right?
Right.
So they smoked everywhere.
Everyone did back then.
Okay. Yeah. So people would get on an airplane and smoke, right?
Yeah.
People would be in the office and smoking, right? At the ball game and smoking. Today, you can't smoke anywhere. I mean, the people have to go and stand outside buildings. That's a common sight now. You're walking down the street and there are a bunch of people kind of hovering over there smoking cigarettes outside 50 feet from the entrance. That's a huge change. It's a big change in terms of gambling. Like when I was a kid, there was such a thing in the neighborhoods as the numbers guy, you know, and it was like almost like a drug dealer or something, right? He sells numbers. Yeah. It's illegal.
Yeah.
And you'd look in the paper, you know, and have some configuration of the numbers from the results down at the racetrack. I grew up in New York, so it was Aqueduct, you know. But that was the now numbers are everywhere. Now there's scratch offs at the 7-Eleven, there's Powerball, all the rest. Mm-hmm. It's run by the government, in fact.
Yeah, yeah. Now there's talk of online gambling coming in. And,
Right. But the biggest change, I think that if the Founding Fathers showed up, as I was saying to you earlier, I think surveillance would be a shock to them. And that's why Bill Bratton is in We the People, because Bill Bratton, he is the police commissioner of New York, but he was police commissioner out in Los Angeles as well.
Right, I remember.
He's been in Boston. So many of his acolytes are now police commissioners around the country. And he came up with computer statistical modeling of crime so that you could tell where crimes occur, what time of day they occur, the people most likely to commit those crimes, and then you could become predictive about criminal activity as you tried to prevent it. Well, that's everywhere now, including the use of cameras, the use of sound surveillance to tell if there's gunshots in an area. This is incredible. And again, I think it strains the privacy, liberty tension in American society.
Yeah, I imagine the Founding Fathers probably would have some issues with that.
Right.
But
I mean, Edward
Snowden
makes
that argument.
But they
also probably couldn't predict the level of crime that we have today, especially in urban areas.
No, I mean, for them, it was more a security against Native Americans, for example, or the British, right? The British actually would come back.
Yeah.
So they had constables, you know, night watchmen and things like that. But they had no sense of the kind of criminal activity. I mean, they were murders and robberies and the like, but they didn't feel the kind of threat that we feel on a daily basis from crime in American society in the 21st century.
Right. And that's kind of the era of Old West justice, where they were still tarring and feathering people and hanging people.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about that was when I was looking at that chapter.
A whole different sense of justice.
Yeah. But people live so far apart. Remember, close to half of the people are farmers. They're living on farms.
Yeah.
They don't get together. They don't see another neighbor unless they do so intentionally. So crime at that point is of a different nature altogether.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And like Bill Bratton, there are some cases in here of people who their contribution may be more in terms of broader cultural shifts. Who are some other examples of people who, without necessarily altering the founding document, may have extended the spirit of the founders over the past century?
Well, I don't think anybody in the book altered the basic framework of the Constitution. In fact, I mean, to me, if the Founding Fathers show up, the reason they're rock stars, the reason that you want them on this podcast is, wow, you guys created something 240 years ago that endures, that people left and right respect and say, you know what, I don't agree with you, but it's got to be constitutional. We are a nation of laws, and we are a nation of laws built on this constitutional bedrock. That's everybody seems to agree on that. And the idea that has been able to manage all the changes that I've described from Civil War to World War, that's an incredible achievement. And that's why people have such reverence for the founders. So I don't think anybody in the book has altered that framework. But if you look at somebody...
But you do have Supreme Court justices like Thurgood Marshall.
Well, and, who come and in. Warren, right. You know, so you have these liberal
who interpreted
justices.
It, yes.
who believe that the Constitution is a living document and that, for example, with regard to civil rights, that you can say the government should not enforce segregation, that, you know, 14th Amendment, equal rights, equal protection. We have got to protect the rights of blacks, Latinos, et cetera, just as whites. And so the government goes from protecting segregation to then opposing by enforcing integration. Right. That's a big change in schools. And of course, it's rippled out across American life. And it's also another chapter of the book then generated a response, which is Ronald Reagan and Ed Meese.
Right.
Because they come along and they say too many of these judges now are finding new rights and privileges in the Constitution. They are not simply seeing the spirit of the Constitution. They are bending it. They are bending it. And we think it's unrecognizable. When Justice Scalia, just shortly before he died, wrote a dissent in the gay rights case, he said, you liberal justices, you're the majority ruling on this case, are finding rights for gay people that's not articulated in the Constitution and that nobody has found for centuries. You're creating new rights. So for him, this was a distortion. For Ronald Reagan, for Ed Meese, people who are advocates of limited government and trying to push back against government intrusion in our everyday lives, they see these activist judges as a threat, unelected legislators from the bench. And so they say, let's cut that back. So you have not only a Justice Scalia, but remember the huge arguments over Robert Bork?
Right. Oh, yeah.
And so because these are all Reagan, these people. So, I mean, you just stop and think about people like Chief Justice Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Alito. They all come out of that period and that mindset. And the idea is we're going to put people on the bench who are going to get back to a strict reading, strict interpretation of the Constitution as it was written, an originalist understanding in the spirit of limited government. So that's the response. So again, you have the Thurgood Marshall, the, you know, Earl Warren Wing. They've made an imprint on the way that we live today. And then you have people like President Reagan, Ed Meese, and the judges that they have appointed who are pushing back, and they've made an imprint on the way that Ben lives as he walks around in America in 2016.
Yeah, and as I was reading it, I was trying to divine where you fall on this, because you do have great reverence for the Founding Fathers and the Constitution, but you also embrace change or evolution, let's call it. So where do you fall? Are you a constitutional originalist, or do you believe in the quote-unquote living, breathing document?
Well, I think it's both.
Philosophy.
So to me, it's like steel. It's like steel in the sense that steel provides the skeleton, the structure, and it's strong enough to hold in the midst of storm. But in the midst of storm, I don't know if you realize this, but steel has the capacity to bend to some extent, to sway. I think of the Constitution as that kind of structure. So, for example, the Founding Fathers as human beings, I mean, they had no concept of women as equals. Let's just be straight.
Right.
Okay? So it's not the case that if you run into Ben or George Washington, they say, oh, yeah, you know, there are no women signing the Declaration of Independence. There are no women at the Constitutional Convention. Women could not own property in their day. Right. Women could not vote. So let's just be, you know, that's just direct. Okay. So they show up today and Ben says, you know, I'm trying to get Hillary Clinton on Kick-Ass. And they say, why do you want her? And they say, oh, she's the leading Democratic candidate right now for the presidency. So they'd be like, are you kidding? What? A woman? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
You'd say, women? Well, no. In fact, you know, women are now like, and if you're selling consumer products, women often make decisions about family budgets and the like. Women are the majority in college, the majority in graduate school. Hey, Founding Fathers, there are three women on the Supreme Court. They'd be like, Ben, you got to be kidding me. Are you serious? You know.
Yeah.
So when you look at them as human beings, you realize so much has changed. And it's not a matter of that they, for example, it's not a matter of me saying, oh, I believe in a living constitution, as I believe in a constitution that has been able, it's so strong, it has been able to adapt to these changes in culture, in politics, in demographics, in a way that allows us to remain dedicated to constitutional principles and to the, and a, you know, we all, I think, in our hearts, beyond anything we say explicitly, we pledge our allegiance to the Constitution of the United States of America.
You know, the book includes a wide range of disparate personalities, from Barry Goldwater and Charlton Heston to Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Ted Kennedy. I have to assume that there are some in here with whom you perhaps disagree politically.
Well, you know, the one that I have the most
trouble
with. I mean,
they're so contradictory in some sense, there must
right.
be.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But the one that gives me the most trouble is Milton Friedman, the conservative economist.
Yeah.
So Milton Friedman's theory, I think, is summed up in a short story I tell at the end of the chapter on Milton Friedman. So Milton Friedman is confronted by someone who today I would think of as a Bernie Sanders supporter. And this Bernie Sanders young person says, you know, I really don't like you, Milton Friedman, because you're telling corporations that their only responsibility is to make money for the shareholders. You're not paying attention to the workers, the people who, I mean, he's opposed to unions, right?
Right.
He's not paying attention to consumers. He says, well, if consumers don't like what we're doing, they can make choices, go elsewhere. What you're focused on is make the most money. And so the Bernie Sanders supporter would say, this is what we're talking about when we talk about income inequality that results from corporations that are only responsive to Wall Street and Wall Street imperatives, and that only respond to executives who create highly profitable corporations and high level of pay that's way out of keeping, you know, the top employee and the bottom employee. And we see all that. And in response to this, Milton Friedman says, you know, you and I want the same things for America. We want prosperity, community, opportunity, options in terms of where we educate our children, all the like. He says, but the difference between you and me, Bernie Sanders supporter, is that I know how to do it and you don't. And the way to do it is capitalism. And you can't put in place limits on people who are pursuing ideas, creating people who are looking to make money for themselves and for their families. Yeah. That's wrong. So to me, that was like, wow, Milton Friedman's not shying away from the argument. Even as I might have, you know, you said, do I disagree? I would think, boy, Milton Friedman, you are harsh. I mean, he was opposed at a time when we had a military draft. He was opposed to the draft. He's a libertarian in that sense.
Yeah.
He had no problem with marijuana, right? He's a libertarian in that sense. So it's like he's out there in the jungle. It's each man for himself. You live as you please.
Right.
And he doesn't want government to get in your way. So at some point I'd say, wow, Milton Friedman, you are really not one for putting any kind of regulators, moderation on the human instinct, the capitalistic instinct. But I understand what you're doing. It's just sometimes I disagree with you. I just find it a little bit much for me.
So then why did you include him in here?
So if we found Ben's father and my father and we brought them on the podcast and we said, hey, can you believe the percentage of wealth that's concentrated in the top 1% in America in 2016, that if you went back to the 2012 presidential cycle, it becomes a key issue in the campaign with Romney and Obama. And here in 2016, it's a key issue again. It's driven Bernie Sanders, who identifies himself as a socialist, right?
Yeah.
It's driven him to almost the top of the ranks of Democrats in the country. So this is an issue that it has definitely impacted the way we live in 2016, I think in this early 21st century era. So, and I think the driving figure, the man whose hands were in the clay that shaped that, Milton Friedman, conservative economist.
Wow. Yeah, and I have to think that the founding fathers probably had no concept of how much upward mobility there would be in this country. Even in their own time, there really wasn't that much. I mean, these were all elites.
They were elites.
Yeah, gentlemen farmers and plantation owners. But I have to imagine that they probably couldn't even imagine just the Industrial Revolution in the 1800s, much less today, when you know, have so much upward mobility and, you know, tech billionaires coming out of their garages and stuff.
at age
25.
I mean, and you stop and think about it, you know, the argument so famous now between Jefferson and Hamilton over the idea of having a central bank. And having Wall Street, basically, and having investment in a, you know, concentrated form like that. So they would be a little bit put off by the idea of how much economic activity, not only in this country, is taking place way away from any kind of agrarian basis, but that it's global. Remember, they were opposed, and for the most part, to global entanglements.
Right. No foreign entanglements.
That's what George Washington says in his farewell address.
Yeah.
So again, it'd be like, And the other side of Milton Friedman, just to drive home the point that I wasn't trying to pick people I agree with. Mm-hmm. I just picked people who I think are indisputably people who shaped America. The other side of him is someone people may not know the name, Robert Ball. Robert Ball comes into government as part of the New Deal and FDR and the growth of entitlement programs, Social Security, and he helps to maintain the viability, the financial viability of Social Security by structuring it as it continues to grow, and then gets to the point in the Great Society. So New Deal to Great Society, where he creates Medicare,
creates
Medicaid. And that's, of course, has roots today in terms of Obamacare. Hugely divisive, polarizing issue in American politics. So again, it seems to me hard to get away from the idea, conservative or liberal, that Robert Ball has shaped the way that we are living and the way that we understand how we treat each other and what someone is entitled to as a citizen of this country.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is that you do have these disparate factions and these people with ideas on both ends of the spectrum, and how beautifully we seem to, generally at least, find that sweet spot in the middle where things generally work out the most for the most people.
Yeah. So you have these kind of driving larger than life personalities. And I'm not sure I'm right about that. They're not, it's not that if you met Robert Ball, you would be bowled over by Robert Ball. Like if Ronald Reagan walked in, you'd say, man, that's the
bureaucrat.
Yeah, exactly. Government bureaucrat. But that bureaucrat was working away, chiseling with such effectiveness that he has shaped America. So they, you know, in the title, I say reshaped and affirmed the values of the founding fathers. And that's true of Robert Ball.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and then I'll be back to talk more with Juan Williams back in just a moment. Hey, folks, do you like reading, but you find it's getting harder and harder to make time to curl up with a good book? Well, there's a solution. Give audiobooks a try from Audible.com. They're perfect for your commute to work or exercising at the gym, a relaxing bath, or any time, really. And right now, you can take an audiobook out for a spin with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics to get a free 30-day trial and download any of Audible's 180,000 titles absolutely free. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. We're back, and today I'm talking with Juan Williams of Fox News. He has a new book called We the People, the Modern Day Figures Who Have Reshaped and Affirmed the Founding Fathers' Vision of America. So, Juan, other names that come up in this book, two that struck me, one I was familiar with, one I wasn't, were Robert Moses, who you credit with creating the modern city. He was, I guess, the city planner
for
New York City. And William Levitt, who I wasn't familiar with, who you say founded the modern suburb.
Yeah.
What elevates these two contradictory men to the level of modern day founding fathers?
Well, remember, Ben, when you think about how we live in America today, we live typically in big cities. Obviously, founding fathers did not live.
Increasingly more so.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Not only do we live in big cities, we live in big cities that are tied into suburbs. Mm-hmm. Right. Into metropolitan areas, as the census calls it, you know, standard metropolitan statistical area. And the connections between them, highways, parkways, then transit systems. That's how we live. And that's how we understand where do you work? Where do you live? Where do you play? Well, that's put in place in large part by Robert Moses in terms of building highway access into big cities. Actually,
right. He saw the car coming.
Yes. Yeah. And what was interesting about him was, you know, in 2016, we think of the car and the highway as a way to get into the big city where the tall office buildings are, where people work, right?
Yeah.
The economic centers of the region. But he was building them to get people out. He was building them so that the wealthy could remain in the city during the week, but know that they could get out to the beaches and the parks for recreation on the weekends. Well, here comes Bill Leavitt. Bill Leavitt comes in after World War II, and his dream is a nice big house with a yard and all the rest. Realizes you can do that by building outside the cities, and he creates suburbia outside of New York, Levittown and the like. And those people use those highways that Moses was creating to take folks out of the city into the city. So now you have workers, not the elite, but workers who find that they can have and afford the suburban house with the yard and then drive in to work and then drive back home. So it has nothing. I mean, it's a different. Yeah. And now we're at the point of gentrification in 2016 where so many people drive into the city to play on the weekend. Right.
Yeah,
that's where
that's
they go to the theater or the concert or the ball game.
Yeah, and you know, I remember Robert Moses was kind of a controversial figure because he was really pushing the automobile in urban areas. And, you know, he was trying to do things like put a highway through a Washington Square park in New York in Greenwich Village.
And I think for sports fans listening to Kick-Ass, let me just tell you this. He's the guy that is behind the decision made by the Brooklyn Dodgers to move to L.A.
Really?
Yeah, because
we have him to thank for that.
Yes, indeed.
Or not.
Well, it depends on how they're doing.
Yeah.
But he opposed the idea of moving the Brooklyn Dodger Stadium, Ebbets Field, down to another area of Brooklyn, which he envisioned as a transit hub. He said, you know, you got to move out to Queens. And he had this idea of a World's Fair site and the ballpark, which is where Shea Stadium is now. And the ownership of the Dodgers said, no, you know, we want that site. And then eventually came out to L.A.
Interesting. I didn't realize that.
The guy was so powerful.
Unelected. Oh, yeah, exactly. Right. And he was city planner for,
forever and ever.
Two or three decades at least, I think.
I mean, some ways he's more powerful than the politicians.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I don't think that many people remember him unless you're a New York history buff, I guess. Right. Well, you know, some others that come up, you talk about the Kennedys, how they changed attitudes on immigration and ethnic limitations in terms of where one could go in life in America. You're the son of immigrants.
I am an immigrant.
You are. Where were you?
Okay. I was born in Panama.
I didn't realize that.
Right.
Oh, so that's right.
My mom and dad. Well, it's my mom who brought three kids to Brooklyn when I was just 4 years old. But my dad was born in Jamaica. His father was born in Jamaica, but his father went to help build the Panama Canal. Right. And so his father, my grandfather dies building the Panama Canal. His son then goes from Jamaica to Panama and lives there and meets my mom, who's born in Panama. And I'm their third child.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a great American story right there.
You know who I make a joke about this with?
Who?
John McCain, the senator from Arizona, because John McCain was born in Panama.
Yeah.
But he was born there as the son of, I believe, an admiral, but a naval officer. But he's born in Panama as well. But he is considered, I'm a naturalized American citizen.
Right.
But he immediately was given American citizenship as the child of an American military man.
Right. Well, according to Donald Trump, none of you can run for president.
Well,
so.
And Ted Cruz is out. Get out.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, does it worry you what you see going on with the immigration debate today?
Of course it worries me because I think that there's, and, you know, for me, it's a totally different kind of debate. Obviously, even back, you know, when I came to this country, so I came to this country in 1958, the level of immigration was so much lower and just not an issue in the way that it is today.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, you asked me, do I worry? I worry when people become demonized.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think the rhetoric becomes harsh and we lose touch with the idea that I think you have to understand, as Jeb Bush said, and it prompted mockery from some corners, but, you know, that these are people who are trying to feed their families. I mean, these are people that you want in some sense. These are the go-getters, people who are, I think, committed to our way of life and seeking our way of life. I mean, America is a beacon to people around the world. They want to come here. For all the arguments we have with each other, people want to be here.
Yeah, I mean, they want to be part of the American dream.
Yes.
They're not really coming over to be rapists and murderers.
I mean, that's what worries me. So if that's
their motivation, you can rape and murder anywhere in the world. Why would anyone want to come here to do it?
Where
the laws are so much stricter.
Yeah, exactly.
Along those lines, then, you know, there are many in the Tea Party and in this Trump wing that's emerged in the Republican Party who are radically resistant to change. Mm-hmm. And they evoke the founding fathers almost as some kind of mic drop just to end an argument. It's like, how do I respond to that then?
Right.
So I'm curious, do you think that some in that wing either misunderstand or misrepresent or misinterpret the intent and the spirit of the founding fathers?
Huh. Well, I'll tell you this much. It's clear to me that they misinterpret the idea that the founding fathers are human beings and fallible. Hmm. And in other words, we all love the founding fathers. As I say, I think if they showed up, they'd be rock stars in every corner and everybody try to claim them. It's like the flag, right? But when you have the politics of nostalgia, and I think that's what you see, people saying, make America great again. Well, what are you talking about again? I happen to think America's pretty great right now, but they say again. And I think what they're talking about is a point at which, you know, there was more kind of pro-American pride. There was greater certainty about America's influence in global affairs. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump talks about winning in terms of trade deals and the like, and not feeling like, hey, what are those Chinese doing, on value of their currency and all the rest?
Yeah.
Are they cheating? Are those Chinese, all that.
Yeah.
So make America great again. But part of that is what you're talking about is, okay, so let's get back to the original founding fathers and the way that they viewed the world. Well, I think they're mistaken if you think that we could live as they were living in 1776 or 1789 when you have the Constitution put in place. I just think that that's too much to ask of a country that is so greatly different.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, they're so obsessed with trade. All trade is bad, it seems, suddenly. And I mean, from the very beginning, the very founding of the country, we would not have survived were it not for foreign trade.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what got us where we are, even as early as the founding fathers.
Oh, absolutely. And it continues. I mean, the reason we develop in terms of global military presence is in large part to protect our ability to trade and to protect it against pirates and foreign interference and the idea that, you know what? Well, not only do we import goods, we send goods. We export pretty aggressively. I mean, you think about right from the start, the idea of the whiskey trade, the sugar cane for the cotton, and then back in terms of the mercantile goods. That's all us. That's the American story. That's how we grew.
Yeah. I mean, we could not have survived on just being a consumer-driven economy that bought its own goods.
Not back then. No, no, no.
We weren't building enough houses to have that big a demand for our lumber and our natural resources right here.
Not in any way. And so I think when people do that nostalgia politics thing, I think you have to say, hey, founding fathers are pretty special and they are deserving of our reverence. But it's not as if you can use them as a cover for you, the fact that you are so discomforted by the rate of change taking place in America today.
Yeah.
But you see this all over. I mean, you said in terms of people on the right, but I see it even in terms of people on the left. At the start of the book, I said, people say things like, I feel like a stranger in my own country. This is not the country I grew up in. And you say, oh, so that's the conservative Republicans who say that. Huh? Wait a second. Slow down. Look at the poll numbers. Majority of Black Americans say the same thing.
Really?
The same thing.
Interesting.
That the change is coming too quickly. And in the book, I cite this very, to me, maybe not to you, Ben, but to me, very interesting number, which is that, I don't know if you know who Buckminster Fuller, Ray Kurzweil, they're futurists.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And so they say, looking at the 20th century, 1900, 1999, if you look at the rate of change in that century and then compare it to what's going to go on in the 21st century, well, 100 years of change in that century is going to be like 20,000 years of change in the 21st century.
Jeez.
So the rate of change is accelerating. And as it accelerates, it's not a matter of simply saying, oh, let's go back. It's more a matter of saying, we want to maintain our constitutional principles, our protection of individual liberties and rights as Americans. And we want to do that in such a way that holds to our founding fathers' effort. But we realize that we're going to be living in vastly different times. The challenge is upholding the founding fathers and what they have given us and not sacrificing it going forward in the midst of this tremendous turmoil that can come with change.
Well, I'm curious. There are some people that you include in this book, like I said, who might be a little bit controversial, particularly at Fox News, mm-hmm. where you are. Harry Hay, who founded the gay rights movement. Like you said, Robert Ball pioneered Social Security. Rachel Carson, mm-hmm. who was kind of the founder of environmentalism, I guess, Silent Spring. Have you had any of your colleagues at Fox argue with you over your list?
Oh, yeah. Because you know what? So people come to me and they say, you know, I'm kind of surprised by your book because I thought that you were just going to celebrate people you agreed with, people left of center uh-huh. that would fit your, because I, at Fox, I'm the guy
right.
who's
you
the,
are the one.
Yeah, I'm the one left of the center right? guy. Yeah. So, okay. So, and they say, but you know, here's Ronald Reagan, Ed Meese, right? Here are people who are strong conservatives in this book, but then you've also got, like, why do you have Rachel Carson, right? Like, we had a conversation about the $20 bill or the $10 bill that they're trying to change?
Oh, is that Alexander Hamilton? I think the yes. $10 bill, yeah.
Okay, the $10 bill. So they were saying the effort is to get a woman on the currency. So they right. said, well, who would you put on there? And I said, well, you know, for my money, you'd have to look at Eleanor Roosevelt, but you'd also have to look at Rachel Carson. So Dana Perino, who's my friend and co-host of right, The Five, says to me, Rachel Carson. I thought, you know, it's like I had held up some kind of horrible, devilish character, you know, and clearly it was anathema
like
to her.
Like you nominated Eva Braun.
Yeah, check it out, right? So she's like, why would you do that? Why would you say Rachel Carson? I'm thinking, look, there's just no getting away from it. Even as conservatives today argue about Obama's efforts to regulate the environment, the EPA, which, by the way, is a Nixon creation, EPA.
Mm-hmm, right.
Right. But you would have no doubt if you stopped and looked at it in terms of who changed our understanding of the society's relationship to the environment. I don't think there's any question you'd say, let's go back to a book published in the early 60s, right. Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, that went right to the heart of the issue of the use of pesticides in mm-hmm. the society, DDT and the like. And had such an impact on our culture that things like not only the creation of the EPA, but Earth Day, all of that, the kind of yeah. people marching, you know, all comes from Rachel Carson.
Right. Well, you know, I don't think there's anyone who doesn't want clean air. I mean, I've never met anyone who's pro-pollution. No. So, well, before we go, I just want to ask, you know, you've been in news and politics long enough that I imagine you may have met some of the people that you talk about in this uh-huh. book. Is there one in particular in here who you haven't met, who you most would have liked to have met?
Huh.
And had so, a conversation with.
Well, you know, I was the White House correspondent for the Washington Post when Reagan was in office. So right. I met Reagan. And in fact, in the book, I have a little conversation. I quote an interview right, with him right. over, you know, race and the founding fathers and dealing with that. Very interesting. But so if you're asking who I would have liked to have met, and obviously I would have been delighted to meet people like Ben Franklin, Thomas Paine. As a journalist, I would love right. to meet Thomas Paine. Gosh, you know, right. he's the original wild journalist of his day, right? I mean, yeah. he's challenging the British authorities in a way that ends, puts him in jail. And then he's at cross swords with George Washington. And he says, Washington's a bad guy, didn't back me up. Wow, what yeah. a journalistic line. Anyway, so who would I have liked to have met?
I mean, of the modern ones.
Yes, actually. I get your idea. So I think that for me, there's little doubt that I would love to have a conversation with Milton Friedman. Remember, we started off and I told you yeah. that I end that chapter where he's confronted by a Bernie Sanders type supporter. Yeah. So, you know, when
would you have been that Bernie Sanders?
I'm not a Bernie Sanders supporter, but okay. I would have loved to yeah. have had a real honest conversation. Now, the thing mm-hmm. about Milton Friedman was he wrote columns. His communication skills, non-parallel, right. oh, terrific. Yeah. So, the idea that you sit down and say, okay, so this is what's come of your way of thinking. Definitely not Keynes, right? This is
yeah.
government that governs the least is government that governs the best. In that spirit, with regard to our economic growth and the fact that so much is globalized and that you have people who feel lost at this moment in American society. And I think arguably so many of them are Trump people who feel like
right.
the government, the politicians, not looking out for us on these trade deals. They don't understand that people are being hurt, that there's small towns being left behind, etc. So Milton Friedman, what do you think? Is it the case that corporations should just be about profit? We have this thing now, this argument over corporate inversions, you know, corporations right. going overseas
yeah.
and saying, well, we pay less taxes. Our job is to make yeah. money for our shareholders. So if your tax rates are higher here in the United States, we're leaving. Even though we started here, we're created here, we're out. So Milton Friedman, right. how do you deal with this? I would be interested in that conversation.
Yeah, I would be curious what he would think about the whole mortgage bailout and all of that.
Yeah, too big to fail.
Yeah, too big to fail.
Right.
Well, again, the book is called We the People, the Modern Day Figures Who Reshaped and Affirmed the Founding Fathers' Vision of America. Juan Williams, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Man, I'm honored to be on Kick-Ass. I hope we kicked ass. Well,
I know you did. I don't know what I did, but...
But well, thank you.
Yeah. You,
thanks,
I leaned on you, perhaps.
There you go.
Well, the book is terrific. I hope people get it.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks again to Juan Williams for coming on the show. And if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to order his new book, We the People, the Modern Day Figures Who Have Reshaped and Affirmed the Founding Fathers' Vision of America. I'll include Amazon links in the show notes and on our website where you can order his book. You can follow Juan Williams on Twitter at @TheJuanWilliams and see him every weekday when he co-hosts The 5 on Fox News at 5 p.m. Eastern. Now don't forget to go to podcastawards.com to nominate Kick-Ass Politics for a 2016 Podcast Award in the People's Choice category and the News and Politics category. The deadline for nominations is coming up this Saturday, April 30th. So go there now to podcastawards.com and show your support for Kick-Ass Politics. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics or click on the donate button on our website at kickasspolitics.com. Follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook. And while you're there, recommend Kickass Politics to your friends on your social media. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. On the next podcast, my guest will be Steve Case, co-founder and former CEO of America Online and former chairman of AOL Time Warner. As one of America's most accomplished entrepreneurs, Steve Case made the internet part of everyday life and orchestrated the largest merger in the history of business. Now he says we're entering the third wave of the internet's evolution, a period in which entrepreneurs will vastly transform major real-world sectors like health, education, transportation, energy, and food, and in the process, change the way we live our daily lives. Steve will explain the ways in which newly emerging technology companies will have to rethink their relationships with customers, their competitors, and the government. And he'll give advice for how entrepreneurs can make winning business decisions and strategies in this changing digital age. Coming up with Steve Case on the next podcast. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.